We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Wow. I just think of all you looking at me. Thank you, Leanne. Thanks for having me. This is great. I really, I want to thank Leanne. I want to thank the committee for taking care of the speakers. You guys just really do a great job. And I don't know why it's called the Young at Heart meeting. I just, all I see is that it means old in body. And then I realized it's at 4 o'clock and we're all missing our nap, you know? And so it can't be that old, can it? It's really an honor to be here. I was looking out, and I was just looking at you guys, especially after you mentioned all the faces looking at you, and I thought, you know what? These are all the people that saved my life. And, you know, that makes it okay. I realized I love every one of you, and I don't know every one of you, but you're responsible for me being here, and I thank you. It's truly an honor. If there are new people in the audience who are new to AA, hey man, welcome to Nowhere to Run. life's in session, man. And without cocktails, it's pretty high def. It's 1080 DPI, man, isn't it? And it's really just something else. To see the energy at this conference is terrific, you know, to see all the people in the... If you were at Equipa a month ago up in Irvine, yeah, I'm sorry, I'm the main speaker again here, and there are other speakers, and I encourage you to go see Steve, too, who's speaking. It's great to see you again, too, Steve. We were at Palm Springs together last summer, and... it's just always great to regroup with you guys. If you are new, I'm just a falling down vodka drunk. That's what I am. That's what you're looking at. And I haven't had to have a cocktail since May 8th, 1986. It's great to have been sober for 22 years. One of the problems with that is you have to be willing to be 52 years old to do it. And I've surrendered to that. But I'm a falling down vodka drunk. Without you people, that's what I do. I drink vodka and I lay down, and then it's your problem. And I love blacking out. Blacking out's fantastic because I don't know how to deal with people. I'm terrified of people. From the gate, I've been terrified of people. And I'll tell you what, from my first blackout when I was 13, I loved it. Blacking out was terrific because I could still, all of a sudden, I can go to parties, you know. I'm at the party. I just don't have to boot up any software, you know. It's just a screensaver for me, you know. It's just fish, you know. So I've always loved blacking out, and I always have. I don't know that I've ever taken a drink where I wasn't rushing for blackout. I had a program when I got to you guys. I had a program for living. It wasn't 12 steps. That seemed a little extreme to me. I had two steps, really. I was raised pretty much by my father, and he was really a good guy. He had a timing problem. He kept starting marriages before he'd ended the last one, and... But he kept me with him, and it was just me and him, and he taught Sunday school, oddly enough, and... We'd go to Sunday school every Sunday, and I'd go to the little kids' classes, and he'd teach the older kids, and we'd walk home from Sunday school, and I clearly remember being about 4.5 years old, walking home hand in hand, and I remember looking up at Dad and saying, Dad, explain God to me. I don't understand God. Who is God? It's just, I get the Easter Bunny and Santa. I can't get around God, and I clearly remember him looking down at me and going, you know, pal, I really couldn't tell you. And I was stunned at 4.5. I was like, what? You don't know? It was like you have the keys and the wallet and you don't know? And it was at that time I made the decision, I will handle this. we need cash and we need a mom, and I'm on it. And and it was at that time I formulated my program for living at 4.5, which was if you were a woman, I wanted you to love and mother me. That was step one. Step two is if you were a man, I wanted to borrow money. And or meet your wife or girlfriend and get her to love and mother me. And my higher power was whether you liked me or not, the look on your face when you saw me. If you were smiling and happy to see me, that was my higher power. If not, and what that did is when I was in a room this size with this many faces, I'd assign a voice to every face, which makes for a busy head. And blacking out is a great solution. And I didn't know that, but that's what was happening. And when I turned 13, I found my first alcohol with Pat Kenyon in the basement. We had Boone's Farm apple wine, and we had a bottle between us. And there is no Boone, by the way. There's no farm, and I don't think that's wine. But we drank it, you know, and we were sick, and it was just pass out time, and it was great. I couldn't wait to do it again, and that's how I drank. We lived in my dad and I married into a normal family. They weren't alcoholics. They were really nice folks. We lived in a little town in northern Idaho, and grew up there, going to a little school in this little mining town, and I got to go to college there, mainly because it's not hard to get into college in Idaho, because you had to have a truck. And we had a truck, and so I got the full 4 years. I didn't know what to do. I got to college, I was just baffled. It was more, there were four times more people on campus than in my hometown. I was stunned. I couldn't get enough blackouts in. And I went to the counseling center. Everyone had a major. Everyone had declared a major. I didn't know what I was there for. And I said, I don't know what to do. And the counselor, he said to me, he said, what are you good at? And I said, well, let me think about it. Can I come back tomorrow? And he said, yeah. And so I went home and I got drunk with my roommates and blacked out. And I realized what I'm good at is covering for blackouts. I went back the next day and I said, I figured it out. I'm an excellent liar. He said, well, maybe you should look at the theater department then. And because he knew I wasn't going to get into law school. And So I went to the theater department, and these were people who partied like I did, and it was great, and we played, and we drank, and what I learned in college, I did not have an academic ability to focus. I was not a great student. What I did learn, because I was a poor kid, we were poor going to school, what I learned was I had never spoken to girls, really. I'd never been able to speak to girls. I was just terrified of women, and I developed in college this sort of misunderstood genius poet thing that I really, I know too much, and perhaps you could buy groceries. I'm just thinking big thoughts. Maybe you could do laundry, too. And I got really good at this sort of bohemian poet thing, and it attracts a certain kind of woman, generally in nursing. And God bless Al-Anon, by the way, if there are any Al-Anons here. No, I want to say God bless you, because I mean, if it weren't for Al-Anon, I wouldn't be here. Let me tell you, my first sponsor made me go to Al-Anon, and because I got sober, I was still terrified of speaking to people, and I didn't know how to stand up and speak to people. And in Al-Anon, I learned that my fear is that you're judging me. And it's in Al-Anon, I also learned that it's my job to help you bottom out on that behavior. And so God bless Al-Anon, really. Anyway, I took this act on the road. I got out of college. I don't know how I got out. I moved right to the Haight-Ashbury, where my older brothers had lived in the Haight-Ashbury. I knew you could be a misunderstood genius poet there and sort of make a living somehow. my career plan was to get famous. That's what I thought. Because I'd seen people that got famous and they had like an entourage and limos, and I thought, that's the ticket right there. That's the career path. If I could just be cute enough that I get famous, then people will handle rent and all that stuff. And so I moved to San Francisco. I started working in little bars there, performing, doing comedy. And I didn't drink that much when I worked, but when I got off the shows, and I had I had stage fright the entire time I was doing this. I want you to know, I was petrified the whole time, and which doesn't lend itself to a lot of laughs. But I worked through it, and I was doing this, and I'd get off stage and just start drinking like crazy, you know. And I would meet women. I found a way to do my bohemian thing. I'd hang out. There was a bar right across the street from where I lived in the Haight-Ashbury called Bradley's. I'd hang out at Bradley's, and it was just a funky bar during the day. At nighttime, though, all the gay guys would do this bar crawl from the Haight-Ashbury over to the Castro, and they'd hit Bradley's. They'd just inundate Bradley's and take over for like a few hours. And I'd still be there drinking, and they'd like, hey, and they, are you gay? And I'm like, well, I don't think so. No, not yet. And and they'd pour me doubles, you know. So I'm like, okay, we're hanging. And and every once in a while, a woman would come in late from work, you know, I'll have a cocktail, and they'd just go, hey, the straight guy's down there. And I'd just go, oh, okay, here we go. And I'd move in, you know, because she clearly had a job. And and I'd move into her place, and then she'd see my drinking, you know, over a period of not very long. She'd realize, oh, man. And she'd say things like, you know, if you don't quit drinking, I'm going to have to leave. And I'd say, well, that's horrible. I'll help you find a place. That's because I needed a lease. And we'd help her find a place, and then I'd take over, and then I'd lose that apartment, and I did this a couple times. I attracted a certain class of woman. That my last relationship was an Irish Catholic mental health nurse, and God bless her. She knew about detox, and I didn't know about detox. I mean, I knew I was alcoholic by this time. I knew I was drinking alcoholically. You can't drink like that. You know, I was timing. I had two blackouts a day. I had like two periods a day. I would have three blackouts, but I had two periods where I could form sentences for about an hour. So I knew I was alcoholic. I just didn't think it killed you. I thought it was just a look, you know. I thought I was just the guy who, you know, hey, and I fall over, you know. And she knew about detox because she was in the mental health profession. I came to in Palm Avenue Detox in San Mateo, California, and I'm looking for a new higher power right away. It's like detox. I'm like, hey, who's the coolest guy? What's the look? And there's no look in detox. There was, it was dreary, man. Everybody was trying to sell their car. And everybody was real despondent, and I was like, man, this is horrible. And I started coming apart. I'd never totally come apart physically before. I don't know about you guys, but that was a surprise the first time, you know, and you're in a building with strangers. It's like, hey, can somebody explain this to me, you know? And there were no meds. Everybody was just like, tea and honey, tea and honey. And I said, oh, good, hot tea, thanks. And that's great. And I grabbed, you know, a cup of hot tea, and it was like, I'm kind of embarrassed about getting it down. I go off into a room by myself to try and get the hot tea down. And I'm there, and I looked up for a second, and I saw a 9-inch high mariachi band, and they were all made of cats. They were all cats. And They were cats, and they had the sombreros and the guitars and the little trumpet, and they were good. They were and And it was just then the guy who ran the place came in to see if I was okay. And I was like, hey, you're just in time, the band. And he didn't see the band. And he didn't hear the band. And that scared the hell out of me. You know, the idea, when your higher power is what other people think of you, your biggest nightmare is that one day you'll lose, you know, your clutch will start slipping. And that terrified me. I got through that detox. I came out of there after 72 hours, and I stayed sober, white knuckling it for 6 months. Just 6 months. Just, I am not going to go nuts like that. And I got to a couple of your meetings, and I couldn't believe you guys. I mean, I loved what you were doing. And I would read this stuff, powerless over alcohol. It's like, that's beautiful wording, and yes, I'm that. But the life unmanageable, I was like, whoa, 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 she's still working. I don't know that it's unmanageable. And you were all happy though. You were so happy and you were all showered and clean and laugh. I thought you were Mormons, honestly. I thought, I'm going to have to get a bike and brochures, and this is just going to be dreary. But I got to a couple of your meetings, and I heard you laughing, and I heard a couple things, you know. And you talked about God, and I'm like, you know, my life isn't quite that unmanageable. And, you know, 6 months went by, and I got working again, and I was in a casino, and an entertainment director sent up a bottle of wine, and, you know, you just had to, and bang, I was back at it right away. And gradually, you know, it just would right back to as bad as it was. And gradually life just started getting small, you know. She was miserable with it. I got asked to not come back to Bradley's, which stunned me. My family, my father and my stepmom in Idaho said, don't come home anymore. You're alcoholic. We don't want to see it. We're not alcoholics. And I was stunned that my father, who had raised me, would say, don't come home, you know, because I still needed money. And I was just in and out of detoxes for the next 2 years. After that first 6 months, the next 2 years, I did a number of detoxes in the Bay Area. She would just drop me off at places, horrible places. I detoxed at home. You know, and I would get well for a couple weeks, and then people would hire me, and I'd end up, they'd fly me places to do shows, and I'd get there, and I couldn't talk. And boy, do they hate that when they've hired you to talk. You know, so I flew a lot of places and got drunk and then flew home and created a lot of resentment. And life just got small. It just got small. I wanted to be somebody. You know, all I wanted to do was be somebody and have you guys take care of me. I didn't have any living skills. My last run, I had come to in New York City, and somebody put me on a plane. I got home and was sent to a medical detox back in San Francisco, and came to in San Rafael, California, at Lincoln House. And I had, before that run, I had wanted to be somebody. I had no money. Before I went on that run, I had no money. I had the clothes I was wearing on my back. She had said, I'm done. I was asked to leave the house. My plan was to live under the park bench across the street from Bradley's. And I was on national syndicated television 4 times a week in blackouts. So if you really want to be somebody, you can be somebody, and this disease doesn't care. That's the only reason I say that. And I got into that detox, and I had no more hope. All I wanted to do was drink or die, because that God had failed me. Fame had failed me. The family failed me. She'd let go. There was nowhere to go. I had no more games to run. And I came to in that detox, and I knew I was going to be sick, and I just wanted to kill myself. And I've never known how to kill myself. I've never tried. I don't have that skill. I'm not a violent, you know, guy. I had fingernail clippers on me, and I knew that would be tedious, and but I said a prayer. It was the first prayer I'd said since I was 4.5 years old. I said, if there is a God, give me a flicker of hope. That's all I wanted. Just give me a reason to go on. And I started feeling sick and right downstairs, and there were some guys in from H&I. Another guy checked himself in, and they were you guys. It was AA was in that detox. And these guys did a meeting, and I heard what they said. And a couple guys from the Haight-Ashbury, I sat through that, and I listened to you. And all I wanted to do was laugh again. That's all I wanted to do. By this time, I had not laughed in 1.5, 2 years. And I didn't care what I did for a living anymore. I don't care if I have to pick up litter on the beach with a stick. I don't care. I just want to laugh again. And a couple guys from the Haight-Ashbury showed up after that detox and threw me in the back of a Volkswagen Bug. And the big guys, Austin and Charlie, and they were laughing. They were like, ha, 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 ha. I was like, where are we going? They're like, to a meeting. Ha, 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 ha. And we did. We went to a meeting in the Haight, you know. And Austin was great. He became my first sponsor. I moved on to his living room floor. I had to get out of her place, you know, and I moved on. He ran the Haight-Ashbury detox. Austin's fantastic, man. These homeless guys would come up, and they'd be all tremory, and they'd have their flea-bitten dog with them. They'd come bum a dollar, and Austin go, why don't you check in, detox? They go, no, I got to take care of the dog. He'd go, Austin would go, why don't I shoot your dog, save your life? And they'd like, oh. And I would just like, dude, you are so bad. He was great, my first sponsor, man. I just started hitting meetings. That's all I did. I hung with you guys all over San Francisco and got a little job. I had to get a little job. I couldn't believe it. I got a job at a warehouse. Charlie helped me get this job. I had to commute every day on the bus. That was unbelievable, man. And I got home after the first week. I said, I did 40 hours. Look what they didn't pay me. And Austin would say things like, yeah, well, Matt, maybe that's how much service you're worth. And I'm like, hey, hey, hey. We'd hit another meeting, you know. But the laughter, that's why I started laughing with Austin. You know, we started laughing. I'd go to meetings. I'd hit noon meetings. San Francisco, I went to a noon meeting in San Francisco. I ran into my favorite bartender from Bradley's. Brian was there. And Brian had a full leg cast on one leg. He had a full arm cast here and a full arm cast here from falling down his own front stairs. He said, hey, Ev, how you doing? I'm like, wow, Brian, what brings you? So we're in this big noon meeting, and right near the end of the meeting, somebody goes and brings him a cup of coffee, and it's like right near the end, and he gets it, oh, thanks, and they set it down on the floor next to him, and they stand up to say the Lord's Prayer. They go, let us pray, and everybody stands up, and Brian goes, whoa, and he gets up, and he kicks his coffee over, and he goes, God damn it, and everybody goes, our Father, who art in heaven. And I, you know how you can't make noise and it's the hardest laugh you've ever had? And you think your head's going to blow off your neck? And you're supposed to be talking to God. Oh, I laughed so hard. And we'd read the book. Even in the book, Austin would grab the book. Okay, let's read Bill's story. We get into Bill's story. Page 16 in Bill's story. This was one of the biggest laughs I ever had. Page 16. One poor chap committed suicide in my home. He could not or would not see our way of life. Paragraph. There is, however, a vast amount of fun about it all. I was like, dude, I can hang with these people. We laughed so hard. Do you get the joke? It's funny, isn't it? It's funny. We didn't hang ourselves in the shower. It's only funny on this side of it. You know that? You know why that's funny to us? You know why that's really funny? It's the funniest thing in the world? Because we aren't supposed to be here. Do you know that? Statistically, this is an empty room. These are empty chairs. I see dead people. I've had so many laughs in this program with you guys. Man, oh man, because everything's silly. Everything's gravy. If you're new, hang on to the seat you're in, because it's a good time. I got crazy. You can go crazy, too, you know. I got right into the steps. I did these steps the best of my ability, made some amends to her, made some amends to the family. I got to go back. My dad was diagnosed with liver cancer and given 6 months to live. Right when I got out of that detox, I was like, Austin, I got to go home. I got to help my dad. And he goes, what help are you going to be if you show up and you're drunk? And I said, well, yeah. He goes, what did he say to you last time you talked to him? I said, he said, don't come home unless you're 6 months sober. He said, why don't you do that? So I did. And I did these steps, the 12 steps in the first 6 months. And you know what? When I hit 6 months, I had bought a little truck from that little job, and I had my 6 months chip from the meeting and the hate at the Baptist church, and I drove nonstop to northern Idaho to get to my dad's bedside, and he was still alive, and he'd waited. And I got to make some amends to him. And he made some amends to me. And I told him about you people. And he said, what you're doing in AA is princely to everyone in this family. And I'd never been princely. And that was a spiritual awakening for me. He died like a week and a half later. And my stepmom said, you know, he was waiting for you. So if you need a spiritual awakening, that's the only one I needed. And I got to have a life. I got to make more amends. I got back. I got to help the family through that, through the funeral. I got to come back. I got to start working again. I saw it as service and not as what can I get, you know? And I got working again, and people put me on the road, and they invited me to L.A. Austin had to move to Arizona. He got a job in a treatment place there, and so I moved down to L.A., and it's like, wow, L.A. was a big thing from the Haight-Ashbury, because you got to have a car, you know? You got to have shoes that match your car. You got to have... You know, because we're nuts, aren't we? I talked to my friend Craig in Arizona. One time he picked me up at the airport. He said, Evan, I just realized I'd rather go to prison than look bad. I said, dude, that is everything we're about, man. So I started shopping. You know, I was on the road working a lot and started shopping, and I hadn't found new meetings in Hollywood yet. I was trying to get to a couple, but I wasn't really connected, and I was traveling a lot, and I was getting a little twitchy. You know how we get when we're in between meetings? And I was on the road. I got hired. I was up in the Bay Area, and I was in a hotel, and I woke up from a nap, and all the furniture was moving around the room in the hotel, and it was that quake. But I didn't know that. I thought it was God. And I thought God was talking to me. And all I could think was, oh my God, I got to marry somebody. And I should have a family by now. And I was just, I don't know why that was the first thought. And the phone rang, and it was a woman I'd met in Vancouver. She had like, I don't know, she was 2 weeks sober or something. And I was like, oh my God, this is a total divine sign. You're it. And she was like, what do you mean? I said, all the furniture, you're it. I'll come get you. And she was like, really? I'm like, yeah. And I like drove up to Canada in like a week or so. And she got in the, she looked great in the car. And we listened to U2 all the way down the coast. And got married on the beach, you know, we got married on the beach, and it was like we had the most spectacular 2 months ever. And there came a point in my apartment in Hollywood where I was like holding up the end of my designer sofa, and she had a knife, and I was like, I'm gonna get back to some meetings, man. I got to get a new sponsor. Because I knew this had never happened. This was not in the promises. And, you know, I called everybody I knew in L.A. that was in the program. And you guys, you know, it was a bunch of guys I worked with, and they hooked me up. They hooked me up with Howard P. And Howard P., I called him, and, man, he said, let's get together. And we started hitting meetings right away. And Howard got me right into the steps. Step one, I'm powerless over her. My life's unmanageable. Clearly. I'm insane. I was insane. I didn't want to drink at any time. I did want to throw myself off the designer balcony. I'm insane. God can restore me to sanity. Why not? God has restored all of us. He's relieved us of this obsession. I'm sure it can happen. I've heard all your stories. Okay, how about a little inventory? You're willing to turn your life? Yeah, let's do a little inventory. Okay, what happened? Well, I'm angry at her. What happened? Well, okay, I got scared. I was in between meetings. I was in an earthquake, and I kidnapped a woman from a foreign country. Okay, what's my part in that? Well, why is she so angry? Well, you said you loved it. Love, what is love? People talk about love. What is love? And I talked to Howard, and I looked at his marriage. I don't know. He and Pat have been married, I don't know, 1,000 years? And I looked at a lot of literature, and it was in Road Less Traveled. He talked about love being an action. Love being an action. When I take my wants, whatever I want, I put them aside. I ask what I can do to make your day go better and take that action. That's love. Anything less than taking the action is an intent to love. I have a lot of intent to love. Okay, knowing that, can I love her? Can I take the action necessary to provide for her here? No, I can't. I don't have the resources. I don't have the time. I made a promise to her I can't keep. What's the amends? What does she want to do? She wants to be safe. How about this? I move you back to where I found you. I set you back up. How about that? How about I try and restore your life to what it was as best I can? Okay. And to follow through on that, and to spend the money, and to take the time, and to follow up for 6 months, and make sure she's okay, and to go back up there, and make sure she's safe, and find out she's okay, and she's working, she's in a safe place, her life is as close as it can get back to it is, and the drive back down the coast to feel that freedom. One more time, you guys have a solution, and it's a spiritual solution. Let's get into action, you know? And I got back from that trip, and I felt this freedom. And it was like, oh, man. And I'd made all these amends in my life, except for the IRS, you know, because the IRS, they keep a tab, you know. Like, they keep a running tally. They send you memos, you know. Hey, it's up to this now. And you go, good, yeah, I'm on it. And I got home from that trip after that divorce. I got home, and there was a letter in the mail, and it just said, pay now. And it had this number next to my name. It didn't say, hey, how's your marriage, you know? Sorry about, you know, the divorce. How's your program going? It just said, pay now. And I lost my mind. One more time, I was like, ah, that's it. I got to leave the country. I can't. I went right into fear. That's where I go. If I don't have enough of you guys, I go right into fear. I got to get out. I didn't pay the cover. I got to leave the club. And I just started loading camping gear into the vehicle. Because I'm going to Mexico. And I figure I'll call Howard before I go. I was all loaded up, ready to go. I'll call Howard. He's been a good sponsor. And he was. He was a great sponsor. He was an engineer. And he never quoted scripture or anything. He just talked about the rings of Saturn and swirling electrons. And so, it was so fabulous. I'll call Howard, let him know I'm on my way. And I called him up. Howard, yeah, it's Evan. Look, you've been a great sponsor. I want to thank you for all you've done. We did some really good work. I'm heading out. And he said, where are you heading to? I said, I got to go. I have this problem. He said, a problem? I said, yeah, yeah, big problem. He said, you know, Jesus had problems. I said, yeah, look, I reckon he did, Howard. this is a big problem. He said, Jesus' problems were pretty big, don't you think? I said, well, yeah, to him. He said, there have been problems since Jesus' time. He says, have you ever not had problems? I says, no. He says, me either. He said, I reckon there will always be problems. What's fantastic is we have a program for living with 12 steps where we can walk head on at any problem. We apply these 12 steps, we come out the other end, there's a miracle. Isn't that fantastic? And all the fear just went away. Because I knew he wasn't lying. I knew he'd never lied to me. I knew you guys had never lied to me. I'd heard your stories. I'd seen your lives change. I said, you're right. I'm going to unload the car and I'll call you back. And, when I did, and I called him back. And one more time, I'm powerless. I'm powerless over the IRS. My life is unmanageable. And God can restore me to sanity. I'm insane around it. I'm ready to leave the country. Okay, I'm ready to do a little inventory. Let's give God a shot. Did some inventory. Okay, I haven't paid my taxes in this many years. Why not? Because I don't like paying taxes. Why? Because, you know, I don't like the way they spend my money. And no, really, it's like I don't care about a car on Mars. I don't know whose idea that was, but I think it was a waste of cash. And I don't care about tanks in the desert. I don't care about all these things they're spending money on. And well, what do you care about? What about the things that have been provided for you in your life that you do appreciate? Let's make a list of those. Okay, well, I was educated in great public schools. I was fed. There were hot lunches. The streets were safe. The street lights were on. There were playgrounds. We're in the safest culture in the world. I had health care, I had dentistry, I had clothes on my back, I had, you know, great education. You look at all these things, you know, okay. What's your favorite thing that tax money pays for that's concrete? I like the yellow line down the middle of every street. I love that double yellow line. I would like to invest in that. Are you willing to call the IRS? Yes, I am. We're ready. We're going to set it up here. I'm going to set the money aside. I'm going to do this. I'm willing to take your advice. I called the IRS lady, and we set up a payment plan. And I said, now, before we go further, and I send these checks, can you guarantee me that my money will go towards yellow paint? She said, of course it can.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
So I started sending checks, and I realized I gotta reduce my lifestyle. You can live pretty high in the hog if you aren't paying taxes. I was pretty comfy, and I had to live cheaper. And I was upset about it. I called Howard. He sent me to a meeting in the Marina Del Rey, and I went out to the meeting in the Marina Del Rey, and I was at this meeting grinding on my taxes. How am I gonna do this? I gotta live cheaper. And the secretary of the meeting, Jan Rand, and I went walking around. We went to Edie's Diner and then went walking around in the marina afterwards. And we were walking around. I said, the IRS, and I got to pay this money. I got to live cheaper. I don't know what to do. And she goes, you know, that boat's for sale. I said, that's what I need is a yacht. Thanks for listening. That's great. She said, no, I know. Frank's got to sell it. You could buy it. You could live cheap on it. You could put everything in storage and so pay the IRS. I went, really? And it was a sailboat. It was a little fiberglass sailboat. I'd never sailed a boat, but I'd seen like Newport commercials, you know. And I knew you could look cool doing it, you know, with the cigarette and the... And I talked to the guy and it was cheap. And and I put the money down. I bought the boat and it was just... I put everything in storage, and all of a sudden, I'm living on this little sailboat. And I realized right away, you got to sail the boat. Otherwise, you're just the homeless guy on the boat. And I started working on the book. I started reading everything I could. I got every boat building book. I was reading the Annapolis Book of Seamanship. It was my Bible. I'd read the Annapolis book. Okay, I got to be able to do this. I did the Coast Guard thing. I was like, it took me a year rebuilding this boat. I took the mast down. I did all the rigging, everything, and got it safe. And I was ready to go. And I went to a meeting. This is a year later. I'm paying the IRS. I'm working. I'm going to meetings. A year later, I go to an AA meeting in the at the Marina Center. I go, I'm going sailing tomorrow. You guys want to come? Everybody's like, have you had lessons or anything? I was like, how hard could it be? I've read everything. Come on. Nobody went with me. But the next day, I went out, Marina Del Rey Channel. I'm like, I'm back out. Here we go. We're going sailing. And I went out to Marina Del Rey. I get into the harbor there. And I'm like, okay, what did it say in the book? Up the mainsail. And I, up the mainsail. And I start cranking up the main. And I get it up and cinch it up tight. And in between the condos, there's like a venturi, a wind, between the basins. It hit that mainsail, and everything I own of value is on this boat now. And the whole thing just starts going over like that. And that's not in the book. How is this? Like, it's like, oh my God. It's like, it's like end of the lesson. It's like, let out a rope, and I just let go of all the rope, and the boom swung out like that, and the boat came back up, and it moved forward. And I was like, well, that's how you sail right there. This is, by God, ahoy, everybody. Somehow or other, I got back to the dock later that afternoon. And I grabbed the Annapolis book, and I was like, okay, what the hell happened out there? And basically, over three chapters, what it says is we have no control over the wind or the waves or the tide or the elements. We only have control over the attitude of our rudder and the attitude of our sails. And I was like, where have I heard this crap before? But I was exhausted, and I realized, here was the big realization. I realized from the moment I had untied that boat and left the dock, with everything of value I had on it, floating out, the second I had untied from land, I had not thought about one of my problems. They had been gone. They had not been in my mind at all. I had been absolutely free of every little idea I had and just busy concentrating on the geometry of the sails, on the attitude of things, on staying alive. And it was my first real encounter with what you guys call an 11th step. You know? To where all of a sudden I'm not thinking about myself. I'm trying to be in accord with God's elements, you know? And it all sort of made some sense to me. And the next day I went out and I put up both sails. And eventually I left the Marina Del Rey Harbor and I sailed on Santa Monica Bay. And there were dolphins. And you know, every time I did it, my head is clear of all my little problems and my fears about you. And there's no question who my higher power is when I'm out there. You know? And I can't tell you, I would have never gotten that gift if I hadn't agreed to do the 12 steps and pay my taxes. One more time, you guys gave me peace. And I tell you, these steps are magical. If you're new, just grab them, man. Just grab them and jump in. I've had the best time. I've had the best time working with new guys. It's so great to take new guys sailing. Oh, man. I had a guy from the VA, Larry. Larry had 6 months. He got 6 months sober. It was 4th of July, and I took a couple guys from the meeting and Larry, and we went out to see the fireworks, and it's dark on the Marina Del Rey Channel. They're getting ready to do the fireworks, and you can't see. You just see a bunch of boats. And I'm motoring out there, and they're all laying on the deck, and I'm looking out for the fireworks, and a fireboat goes, back up, and I went, back up? What are you talking about? And the barge with the fireworks was right there, and I was like, ah, and I'm like, and I back up, and they just started firing these cannons, right? It was like, ba-boom, and it was like, oh, my God, and it went off. We were just screaming for a half hour, just, ah, ah, ah. And then the big, it all ended. It came down. It was like, oh my God. And people are honking their horns. That was fabulous. Woo. And my friend Paul, he had about 6 years. Paul goes, hey man, wasn't Larry in Nam? And I'm like, it's like, Lair. And he was up in front of the mass. I said, Larry, you okay? And he just turned around. He had this big grin on his face. He was all sweaty. He said, I was a little twitchy at the finale, but I'm all right now. I had so much fun, man. I took one new guy out. He'd done his inventory. We went out. We were motoring out the channel one weekday, and that was a gift. Okay, you done your inventory. We're going for a sail, just the two of us. And we go out, we sail, and they had not moved the buoys, and the silt had come up after the storms. I made the turn too soon. We ran aground. It was just, we were stuck in the mud. Just, and I'm like, and this guy just turned around and goes, who's powerless now? Oh, man. I've had so much fun. I've gotten to sail, you know. I got another boat, right? You know, I wound up on another boat. I had friends. It's, you get friends because you learn to be a friend. That's what's amazing. I learned how to be a friend, and all of a sudden I have friends. Friends for long periods of time, people who care about me, who love me, you know, who help me out of scrapes, who I get to sometimes help with scrapes, you know. And it's unbelievable. I wound up, had a guy not in the program. He says, you want to help us deliver a boat back from Hawaii? A sailboat. I said, absolutely. I thought, oh, tropical weather coming out of the islands. Woo, woo, you know. I said, I'm on. And he was racing down with a crew, and I was delivery crew bringing this boat back. Well, I had no idea what bringing a boat home meant. We're coming out of the island. You're coming out of Hawaii, and you're thinking, oh, this will be cool. And then you get like a day into it, and there's storms, man. This is the largest body of water on the planet. And there's serious storms, and we're sailing, and we're like foul weather gear, and we're linked on, and we're like, oh, my God. And we're all seasick. Everybody starts throwing up on one another. We're like, and it's like, what the hell was I thinking? And he's like, how much longer? And he's 19 days. God! Oh my God! And these guys weren't in the program. They weren't in the program. They started out with two beers rolling around in the bilge. We got home, there was one left. I had earphones. I was listening to AA speakers the whole way. Every time I'm off watch, I'm like, give me that. I'm like, oh. But I learned about being good crew, you know. You got to be good crew. And I had to surrender a lot. You learn a lot about yourself being out there. We got out in the middle. I'll tell you something. The Pacific Ocean, you sail north, and you're trying to get around this eye of there's no weather. It's called the high. When you turn on the weather station, you see an H. That's a high. That means there's no wind. There's no waves. It's just hot and dead air, you know. And you try and sail around that because we don't want a motor. We had enough fuel. We wound up, we couldn't get above it, so we wound up having to motor through. It's like 2 days, like 200 miles. You got to motor through this dead air. There's no wind, and it's all calm, and you're in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And we got like 100 miles into it, and we're motoring, and it's hot. And we just decided, the skipper said, it just stopped. And the sails were down. He said, let's go swimming. And we all dove in the middle of the largest body of water on the planet. And it's pretty warm. The sun's out, the salt air, this ever-changing sky. It's a painting changing all the time. And you're just floating on your back. You're totally suspended. And you realize the universe is just this huge womb, and we're absolutely taken care of. And I don't know how deep it is. I don't know if it's like 30,000 feet. I know you don't want to feel nothing hit your foot. And just that little thought, that's when you start inching back toward the boat. But I'll tell you what, sailing on that sail in the night sky, seeing the night sky on this planet, you know, it's just billions of stars and galaxies, and every 40 seconds there's a shooting star or something. Just, I don't know about you, I used to always think of God as this crazy old guy just trying stuff, going, yeah, that didn't work either. Neither did that. I'm like, man. All these spiritual awakenings I've gotten from sailing, they've just been gifts, the greatest gifts. Wayne called me. I learned a lot on that trip. Wayne called me once. He said, I got to deliver a boat San Diego to La Paz. Will you be the navigator? I said, well, yeah, I'll navigate. You in a hurry? And and we left San Diego. It was a fabulous sail, and I plotted our location like every 2 hours. I was like, there were pins on that map all the way around, all the way to La Paz. When we got to La Paz, we got there early, and I was like, how did I do? And Wayne goes, pretty dang good. You know, all you had to do was keep the dirt on the left. I guess it's apparent I'm the only alcoholic on all these crews. It's been fantastic, man. I've had a great time. And I'll tell you, these steps, I've had a number of sponsors. If you're new, don't worry about it. You know, I'm on, I think, my fourth sponsor now, Alan F. in Culver City. And, you know, every one of them has helped me through dilemmas. I paid off the IRS at 12 years sober. And then I got depressed because they didn't send a limo or nothing. And I got upset. I was like, I want a new career. I don't want to perform anymore. I've been performing in clubs. I was still performing. And I realized, at 16 years sober, I realized I have stage fright. I've had stage fright my whole life. I don't want to do this anymore. And I went to my sponsor and said, I want to do something different. He said, what do you don't want to do? I said, I want to write. I want to be a writer. And he says, great. He says, start writing. I says, well, that's the problem. You know, I really don't have that kind of discipline. He says, why not? I said, I don't know. Well, I sit down, I spend an hour, and I got to get up. I can't do it. I can only spend like an hour at a time on the page. He says, well, why is that? And I said, well, pretty much my old man. You know, he had no discipline, couldn't hold a job. And he goes, whoa. Sounds like a resentment. I'm like, hey. I hate hearing that's a resentment. I have new guys I work with. And I'll go, that's a resentment. They'll go, no, it ain't. I'm just pissed at that guy. It was Jack Kay who was my sponsor. He said, you got a resentment at your dad. He says, I think you better do some writing. And I said, you're right. And I did. My dad had been dead. I'd never done inventory of my father. He'd been dead. And I started writing, I realized, you know, and I wrote rage. I wrote like 14 pages of handwritten rage at this guy who had raised me, who had done everything he could for me, you know? And I read it to Jack, and I was like, rah, rah, rah. And he was like, yeah. And I'm like, that's good, huh? And he goes, that's a great inventory. I said, yeah. He said, what's the payoff? Hey, what do you mean? He goes, what's a payoff being that pissed at a guy who's been dead for 16 years? And I went, oh. Well, if I can blame him, I don't have to do anything. He goes, that's right, baby. And I went, oh. And I did the fifth with him. I did the sixth. I did the seventh. And within 2 weeks, I was incorporated. Within 2 weeks, I was spending like 4 and 5 hours on the page writing. I had incorporated. I had created a company, a writing company. I had guys handing me checks within like 3 weeks. Guys were handing me checks to write for them. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. It was that fast, you know? And I'll tell you, whatever it is, it's happened. I found my family. I had never known why it was just my dad. Why did I never have my mom? Why was that not there? And I found a brother found me from Utah. He called, and he had my baby pictures, and he knew my mom, and it was a half-brother. And he had the whole story. I'd never seen my baby pictures. And it turns out my mother was
They had me in 1956. By 1958, she was falling down blackout drunk in Glendale, California. And my dad had married her, had gone to her doctor at Glendale Hospital and said, what do I do? My wife's an alcoholic. And the doctor had told her, if she's an alcoholic, there's nothing you can do. And he went to work the next day and he came home. And one more time, I was crawling around with no diapers and she was passed out. And he just put me in the car and loaded up all the stuff and we drove. And she had tried to kidnap me back, and she'd lost custody of me. She'd lost custody of her other son who had found me and wound up in and out of the Utah State Mental Institution for the rest of her life. And he had a letter written from her to her family doctor asking what was wrong with her. This is from the D ward at the Utah State Mental Institute. I have the letter. It's 9 pages, handwritten. What is wrong with me? Was I dropped on my head as a baby? I mean, I know I drink too much when I'm not in here, but I don't think that's the problem. Why is, what is it? It's an alcoholic crying out for help. You know what? She didn't get this message that you guys carry in 1958. She just didn't hear it. But I think what happened is she made sure I did. You know, through you people. And I'm forever grateful. I'm forever grateful. It's unbelievable. You stick around and you find out all these stories, all these things that happened. He'd been married before my mom. I found another brother in Thousand Oaks. You know, I used to crave having a mother. Mother's Day now is hell. That phone don't stop, man. Chuck called me one time, though. I reconnected with Chuck, and he'd grown up without a dad, and I got to give him some of the memorabilia that Dad had left, and Dad felt horrible about losing track of him, and to give him some of the memorabilia, and he'd never known his dad, and to reintroduce him, you know, and we've become pretty close. He called me one day, though, his mom, my stepmom, Polly, who I'd known shortly. She'd lived with us for a while in Utah for just a short time. And it was funny, you know, this is when I was 19 years sober. 19 years sober, and I was starting to realize in sobriety, none of my relationships with women had lasted more than 6 months, okay? I had called my sponsor. I said, Jack, I don't know what to do. Every relationship I have with a woman, 6 months, you got to get out of here. He goes, what do you mean? I said, girlfriends, romance, friends, even women friends, the same thing. I've tried, Jack. I have women friends and sisters in the program. We're just going to go bowling. We're going to play Scrabble. I said, 6 months goes by. I'm like, you're out of here. And she's like, what? It's Scrabble. I go, I don't care. You're out. He goes, that's strange. I said, I know. And I said another thing. Chuck called me. He asked me to call Polly. She's got Alzheimer's starting, and he's kind of worried. He said, she would love to hear from me and say, I love you. You know, just call Polly and say, I love you. It would really help her out. And Jack, I couldn't pick up that phone. I don't know why. He goes, really? Who was this woman? I said, well, it was my dad's first wife, and she tried to get back. He tried to get back with her. She lived with us for a while, and Chuck, when I was real little, and he said, how long did they live with you? I said, I don't know, 5-6 months. He went, oh, he says, have you ever done inventory on this woman? I said, no. He says, why don't you write her story? And I did. I went back, I found their divorce papers, I wrote out Polly's story. I realized my dad had been married to her, and he'd left her, he'd gone with my mom, and I just realized this woman had raised my brother Chuck by herself, working at McDonnell Douglas, whole career, single mom, put herself through school. She had done a fantastic job. My brother's a really bright guy. He's a copywriter, has a house and a family in Thousand Oaks, doing really, I mean, it's amazing what she did. And she was just a single mom back in the 60s, in the 50s, doing this. And I got a new appreciation for her. And I was able to pick up the phone and call Polly and go, Polly, I love you. How are you? You know? And all of a sudden, I realized for 50 years of my life, 45 years of my life, I had been blaming women for this woman leaving. She had left me after 6 months. I'd promised her to be my mom, and she had left. She couldn't do it. They couldn't get along. She'd gone back, and I'd kicked the bus. I was like, oh, my God. And all of a sudden, I could forgive every woman walking around. I just realized I've been in this jail for 45 years with women. And all of a sudden, I saw all women in another light. And I was on a sober vacation. It was like 2 months later. I was down in the French West Indies. I got to go on one of the sober vacations, and I met a woman from Brentwood who was like in the program and working a good program. And, man, I was like, wow, it was real romantic. It's the West Indies, and you know. Never mind, I went 3,000 miles to meet a woman from Brentwood. And we started talking, and we got along, and it was really good. And we were having a relationship, and it was really honest, and I trusted her, and I was loving her. And we came back to L.A., and it was fabulous. And she was like, now I know your story, this six-month thing. Is this going to come up and be a problem? I'm like, no, man, I'm in this. I'm committed. She was like, you better be. Don't be messing around, you know. And I got to 6 months. I hit 6 months in that relationship, and she gave me a chip, you know? And it was like, it's like, cool, man. Life is good, man. And showing up, you know, showing up, being loving, hitting meetings, working the program. We moved in together, you know? And it was like, we hit a year. We got to a year. And there came a point where she just looked across me at the room, across the room at me, and she just went, you're out of here. And I went, I hear you. I'll see you later. And I could forgive her, you know? I can forgive her. I know it's what we go through. I know forgiveness. I knew by then forgiveness is what we have to work with, you know? And 2 years later, she made an amends to me. It's unbelievable. And we're talking again, you know? It's wild how you just hang in and the miracles come about. This is a fabulous program. I mean, it's worked in all areas of my life. I've got a new career. I've been, you know, new vocation. I'm just having a ball. I love my work. I'm so excited about my work. I sponsor 5 other guys right now, young guys. I love them to death. I love them to death. I'll go anywhere for these guys. I have a sponsor who I see. We share commitments at meetings, my sponsor and I. I see him 3 times a week. I love that. Life is great. Life is great. And the one thing you got to look out for, you got to look out for the spiritual pride. Once this program starts working, it's real easy as an alcoholic to start going, I got it figured out now. I was driving in L.A., and I went past a McDonald's. I pulled into the drive-thru, and I got the drive-thru, and they have a crispy chicken meal. I ordered a crispy chicken meal, you know, on the thing, and I got up to the window, and I paid the woman for the meal, and she handed me a bag, and it felt like more than one crispy chicken meal. And I just sort of went, wow. And I said it over, and I said, thank you, and I drove off. And I got out into traffic, and I looked, and there were like 2 crispy chickens in the thing, and I was like, excellent mistake. That's a happy meal. I just got one over on Mickey D. I got 2 crispy chickens for the price of 1. Yahoo. And I drove back home. I was going to the boat. It was lunchtime. I started scarfing down the crispy chickens. And I was like, good, oh, lunch here, you know. And I started feeling sick right away, you know. You can't scarf down 2 crispy chickens. And I'd been reading Emmett Fox, and it's not thou, you know, the Ten Commandments, it's not thou shalt not steal, you can't steal, you can't get away with it. And I was like, oh my God, this is Emmett Fox and Emil. I'm like, and I called my friend Jim from my men's stag. I was like, Jim, this crispy chicken thing, you know what Emmett said? And I just got 2 and I ate them and decided I was sick right away. And he goes, man, you got to bring that up at the meeting. I'm like, I will. And I got to the stag, and I'm like, you guys, there's crispy chicken, and Emmett's right, and you can't steal. And some guy's, yeah, that happened to me with a modem, and you can't do it, and the computer crashed, and you got to take it back. You'll end up drunk and dead, man. And I was like, oh, I got to go pay for this crispy chicken, you know. And it was like the next day or the day after, I was going by that same McDonald's, and I drove in to the drive-thru. It was lunchtime, and I ordered a crispy chicken meal because it was lunch, and I'm going to pay for this. And I got up to the window, and the woman, she took my money for the meal. She handed me a bag. I looked. There was 1 crispy chicken sandwich. I said, thank you. I said, ma'am, excuse me, how much is a crispy chicken sandwich by itself? And she says, would you like another one? And I said, no, 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 no. The other day I came through, I ordered a crispy chicken meal. I paid for one, you gave me two, and I drove off, and I want to pay for that sandwich today. She said, that was a special we were having. Alrighty. And I realized, you know, humor's human, ain't it? That's why they call it humor, because it's human. And the reason why we never laughed, why I never laughed when I was out there, is because I had no power greater than my own head. This was everything. And when you worship everything this says, all of a sudden you have no perspective. You're too busy taking care of stuff. It's only when I can get a concept of a power greater than myself by doing what you guys do that I can meditate on that. I can sit back. I can get a little perspective on how silly my ideas are. And that's why they say, you know, make God laugh, tell him your plan, you know. Life is good. If I practice humility with you guys, I don't get humiliated, and it's a fabulous life. I love you again. Thank you so much for having me. Have a great rest of the convention. Bye-bye.
Hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.